Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
What a shame that will get. If you've got all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you except for those two have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
I suggest you shut up and show more football.
And you're very welcome along to this week's Team 33 and a call here with you. In this episode, the gang buys a North Welsh football club. We'll be chatting to Spencer Harris, director of Wrexham AFC, about the weird and wonderful takeover of the club by Rob McElhenney, better known as Mac from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and Ryan Reynolds, actor extraordinaire. If you want to get in touch with the show this evening, you can text us on 53106 or you can tweet us at Team 33. That's all spelled out in words. And if you want to listen back to any of this show, you can find us in the OTB Podcast Network. The best place for that is the OTB Sports app, where you can also listen to the show live every Friday at 9 p.m. Before we get to that, I should tell you that issue 6 of Pogba Goal is available to pre-order now. And joining me on the line is co-editor of that football magazine, Jimmy Carew, and contributor to this month's magazine, Jared Farrell. Join me live on the line now. Evening, fellas.
Yeah, I think it's about a year. We were on with you last year for issue 5. So yeah, it's great. Thanks for having us back for issue 6. We're just about to, we've released pre-orders. So yeah, just about to go to print on the next issue. And we're really happy with how it's taken shape.
Jimmy, I suppose in the first lockdown when football went away, there was a real longing for this sort of long-form journalism. And that's really what Pogba Goal is all about. Long-form historical pieces that bring people into the past and that they can read at any time, at any stage. You can leave it down and come back to it. Did you find there was a longing for that in the first lockdown?
I think when we had the last lockdown early in the year, we did an initiative where we would send out issue 5 in actual fact if people just covered postage and packaging. So we reduced the price right down because we knew people were stuck at home looking for material and the copies were flying out the door. So it's definitely, while we're stuck at home, there's an appetite. I think there's definitely harking back for nostalgia, people looking back to old games as you guys were doing when we had no live football, people looking back to the past. And the glory of our magazine is that it's intended both in its writing and its look, is that it's a keepsake. So as you said, the articles are evergreen. It looks great. The photography, the illustration is great. So we want you to hold on to this copy. And that was the whole intention behind it.
Jerry, I can see that you have the classic Roma top on. I suppose you spent most of the lockdown watching classic games, did you?
I was a bit, yeah. And as James said, kind of reading back through, you know, different things, you know, old copies of Pogba Goal or The Blizzard, or, you know, I was online ordering a few football books, so the stack next to the bed is growing ever higher. So yeah, you kind of do want to wallow a bit, if that's not the wrong word to use, in all those experiences. Because look, I'm sure I'm not unlike yourselves, lads, that I miss going to matches. And the next best thing, I suppose, is watching it on TV. But even then, you know, with the fake piped in crowd noises, it's not the same. So yeah, I have, even I was watching back a bit of footage there. I have a piece in the Ireland match program against Bulgaria. I was watching back old footage about Ireland-Bulgaria games in the 70s and things like that, and an aging Johnny Giles running the show and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of nice, because otherwise I'd usually be in, you know, Lansdowne Road tonight or whatever. And you know, that's obviously not going to be the case, unfortunately.
Jimmy, how did you keep it going during the lockdown? Was it hard getting people motivated for the writing, or did you actually find it was easier because people had more time and they actually wanted to sort of block out what was going on in the world by writing about this kind of stuff?
Well, our process is just by circumstance. We produce one copy a year. So we had enough time to kind of gather the content we want and speak to people. But I think it was very much less stressful this time. I think people had more time to put some effort into it. From the editing point of view, we had more time being at home and not kind of doing the work commute and that thing. It felt a little less stressful. I wouldn't say it was easy. It's never easy. But in terms of the way we put it together, as ever, we have contributors from Ireland, such as Jerry, and again, from all over the world. And we're blown away each time that we ask people, international contributors, to work with us, that they say yes. So we're really thrilled again to have such a spread of people contributing.
For a magazine that comes out once a year, how do you actually decide what goes into it? Because I'm sure there's loads of great stuff that is actually contributed and sent into you guys. How do you whittle it down to the best stories?
A little bit of headbutting with my brother, Key, who's the co-editor. In general, we've given ourselves a central theme to the sort of previous, this issue is intelligence, the previous issue was politics. So that's like a very generic thread that can run through it. But when you've got that in your mind, you can bring in stories like intelligent players like Liam Brady, or the kind of secretive nature. We've an article about football in North Korea or Cuba, that kind of thing. So if you give yourself a little bit of a narrative, it comes together. But in general, just topics that spark our interest. So there's a lot of content to get through, as you say. There's small form bits, which can be as simple as the design of a jersey, or, for example, the old tradition of Arsenal having long sleeves or short sleeves as decided by the captain. That's a very short little story, but it's nice and interesting. You can read it in a couple of minutes. To longer form pieces like Jerry's piece on the pandemic, or little bits on a bomb scare at Old Trafford. So it's kind of a combination of agreement and disagreement between two stubborn brothers, but we seem to get there in the end.
There's also photography, right?
Photography, illustration. So just for example, on Jerry's piece, it's illustrated by a Colombian graphic designer. So I love the idea of giving a Colombian artist a story about Bohemians in the early 20th century, and he comes up with it. This is the whole idea of collaboration and football as the universal language.
I suppose one thing that I noticed over the last year or so is that people are sort of moving away from the instantaneous football take, the Sky Sports, the BT, the shiny churn of football, and moving further towards the long form journalism, sort of like The Athletic and Coppa Mundial. Have you found that people are looking for something with a bit more substance as well?
I think so. I think last time we spoke, we said print is not dead. It's very difficult in terms of an advertising or that kind of way to convince people that print is not dead. But people do want something physical to hold in their hand. And as we've been talking about, people have that desire to take a deeper dive into some subjects. So the kind of stereotypical view of a football fan was they were maybe a little violent or thuggish on a match day, and that was it. They weren't interested in things like architecture or art or the design of a stadium. And that's just not true. Football fans transcend all social boundaries. They're from every walk of life. So there's obviously an appeal for this kind of more intelligent or a deeper dive into these stories. You can pick any country in the world, any club in Ireland, and you'll find a story behind it that other people will be interested in.
So along with this piece that Jerry did about the Spanish flu and how football continued in Dublin at that time, what else can people find in this issue?
Yeah, so again, it's a mix of Irish stories like Jerry's on Bowes. We have a piece on Shamrock Rovers. So McDarragh Ferris takes a different view of the kind of Shamrock Rovers nomadic years. He takes a deeper dive into what was seen as the low point when they had to play one of their home games in Cork, and all the kind of impact that had on its supporters. In other terms of Irish content, there's little features on Katie Taylor, for example. It's probably well known that she played football for Ireland before she was a boxer. I didn't know she was actually a school boy in converted commas player of the year in her native Wicklow. So there's a profile on Liam Brady. There's another piece on around the time of the War of Independence in Lurgan in Northern Ireland, an incident where Irish volunteers opened fire on a train full of Linfield supporters. And again, combined with international stories from Cuba to North Korea, We've got stories on Pavel Nedved, Eric Cantona, Michel Hidalgo, the great French coach. So I think there's something for everyone in it.
What was that Linfield story? What happened there?
So in the 1920s, it actually came from an eyewitness statement. The original title of the article was not reported in any papers, because it wasn't. But the incident was reported in Old Irish Veterans, which was compiled by the military archive, actually in the 1940s. So a volunteer at that time recounted this story of Linfield were playing in Lurgan, and the War of Independence had just ended. So the story was that there was bunting put up by the nationalist side of town to celebrate this. And when Linfield were invited, there was reported that there might be trouble. So the supporters came in on the train, and going by the eyewitness statement, as the game went off without any problems, but on the way back, allegedly, shots were fired from the train into streets. And as the train moved on, the Irish volunteers responded by opening fire on the train. And there's no report of this except in these eyewitness statements. I think, again, it's an insight into that time in Irish history.
Yeah, there's actually tons of Irish stories like that from the time of the War of Independence, all through the Troubles, and how the Irish League sort of mixed with the League of Ireland and how things went on. I actually spoke to Brendan Bradley, the top goal scorer for Finn Harps, top goal scorer ever in the League of Ireland as well, about the time that he lived in Derry and was training in Balbofay for Finn Harps and had to travel across the border. And one time he was actually arrested and brought to Belfast. This was during the times of internment, so obviously they didn't have to charge him, and eventually he was actually released with no charge as well. But it just shows you that there's loads of these stories out there in Ireland, and you can really tap into that sort of market.
Absolutely, and no more so than Jerry's story. As Jerry has said in our own podcast that we brought out for the launch, a cheeky little plug there, but we did a chat with Jerry that we do sports history for certain sports, we do very well, like GAA for example, but as Jerry will say, Bohemians is 130 years old this year, I believe. It's like, that's a whole wealth of stories of just one club. And there are these stories around Irish football in general that maybe we haven't been so good at bringing the history to life.
So let's get to the story of Jerry's then. So basically, the Spanish flu, 1917 to 1919. At this time, you also have the end of the World War One, and somehow football found its way to continue in Ireland.
Well, it's an interesting one, and as you say, World War One was just coming to an end, really. So just to set the timeline for people, Spanish flu had a big impact here in Ireland from about summer 1918, so coming towards the end of the First World War. And then the final, there was kind of three waves of it, and the final kind of surge or wave was around March, April 1919. So it was about 9-10 months, so from early summer 1918 through to kind of late spring 1919. So, and just to clarify as well, Spanish flu is probably a bit of a misnomer, because it's called Spanish flu because the first cases that were reported were in Spain, and obviously Spain wasn't a part of the First World War. It was a neutral country, so there was less press censorship. But Spanish flu was rife throughout the trenches of France and Belgium and so on. But obviously, because that's very sensitive tactical military information, that wasn't shared. I think the earliest cases were identified actually in the United States and Kansas, and soldiers leaving the United States who had joined the war in 1917 were helping to kind of distribute the virus around the battlefields of the First World War. And I suppose it's kind of different now. I suppose you didn't have your Ryanair flights or your city breaks back then, especially not when there's a continental conflict taking place, but you know, people were still traveling internationally. There was still a lot of movement. So it was, it's hard to keep the virus out of a country. Now, you had situations where, like Australia, for example, knew that the virus was coming back on ships with troops that were demobbed after the war. So they had situations where they had battleships moored off the coast of Australia, and they weren't letting people in until, you know, they were quarantined and so on. And Australia at the time seemed to, you know, manage with the virus relatively well. But it had a big impact here in Ireland, and that's what I write about in the article, I suppose. You know, really quite significant impact. There's a doctor named Ida Milne who's written a really good book on the subject, but the estimates at the time were about 20,000 people died from the flu in that kind of 9-10 month period. Possibly an underestimate, because there's other people who might have died and were kind of, you know, that was put down to pneumonia or something else. I suppose the other big difference between the 1918-1919 flu and what we have now with COVID was COVID seems to be disproportionately affecting older people at the moment. But back 102 years ago, it was affecting mostly younger people. So one of the theories is that a younger person in their 20s and 30s, because they have a stronger immune system, when they get the flu virus, their body went into overdrive. It was actually their own immune system reacting strongly against the virus that killed them. So you had a tragic sort of situation where a lot of young kids, their parents died of the flu and things like that. But we still have football, which is kind of a strange thing to say.
So where do Bows fit into this then, Jerry?
Well, it's an interesting one. 1913, 1914, the Irish national team is probably at its absolute peak. They're the home nations championship. So every year there was a competition that was played right up until the 1980s. And it was Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, kind of like the rugby Six Nations now. And it was usually played in kind of March, April of the year. And Ireland were actually champions in 1913, 1914. It was the first time they won the championship outright as clear winners. And then obviously 1914, 1915, end of 1914, the war is ongoing. 1915, the season is abandoned. So it kind of goes on for a few months, and then there's kind of a lot of kind of public backlash, you know, people shouldn't be playing football, leagues should be abandoned. Now that kind of changes a bit. I think the authorities kind of realize that, you know, football is good for morale as well. But what happens is the Irish League kind of stops. So Bows and Chels are the only Dublin clubs in the Irish League. So it's mostly dominated by teams from in and around Belfast. You do also have a team from Derry Celtic. But basically it becomes separated. So it's a kind of the highest football in Dublin is the Leinster Senior League, which is Bows, Chels, other clubs you might have known about, like things like St. James's Gate even, and people like that will be in around the Leinster Senior League and so on. So that's the highest level of league football. The Irish Cup, which is, again, a 32-county competition, is still ongoing, but it's regionalised. So Bows and Chels keep getting drawn against each other in the opening round because they're the big conceded Dublin team. So football does continue in a way, but obviously the war has a huge effect. Like in the research I've done about Bohemians, there's over 40 kind of players and club members and, you know, administrators of the club volunteer to fight in the war. And obviously a lot of fans go and fight. So, I mean, conservative estimates put about 200,000, 210,000 Irishmen going to fight in the British Army in the First World War. And then there's more who join the Canadian and American armies and so on later on. So that's a huge amount of like grown men who are the majority of your supporter base. And at one stage, the number of clubs affiliated to the Leinster Football Association, half over the course of the war. And at the end of the war, actually, they're going cap in hand to the IFA, saying, can you give us a loan to basically keep us going because we're going to go bankrupt otherwise. So when the war kind of ends, you know, everyone's scrambling to get lads back playing for them, get them out of the army, get them demobbed. Bows, of course, are an amateur team, so they have to work around people's work commitments and so on. But there is professionalism at the time, like the big northern clubs like Linfield and things that are paying players, and Shells are the first club in Dublin to start paying players. They start doing that in kind of 1905. So they're kind of a semi-pro organization at the time. So everyone's kind of delighted to get football back. So they're, in a weird way, we have this flu virus already by the summer of 1918, but because, you know, the war is finally over, everyone's kind of hoping to get life back to normal. I suppose one of the big things that happens is when basically Armistice Day is confirmed, you know, the 11th of November and all that, what happens when, you know, the war is over? Everyone goes out and has a big party. And that's one of the things they say is like a super spreader event or whatever we would call it today, where everyone goes out and celebrate and have a great time because the war's over, but they're probably spreading the virus as well because there is a peak around October, November. And same thing happens, like there's football matches. I mean, the 1919 Irish FA Cup final, so which is held up in Belfast between Linfield and Glentoran. First of all, there's a match. It's a draw. Then there's a replay. There's also another replay, but I think the highest of those attendances at those games, because they move around different grounds of Belfast, is around about 18,000-19,000 up in Celtic Park in Belfast. So, I mean, that's a big crowd. And even down here in Dublin, there's matches of 6,000, 8,000, close to 10,000. So when that the IFA Cup final is on the same day, Bows invite Belfast Celtic, who are one of the beaten semi-finalists, for kind of like a mini cup final here in Dublin. And that has a crowd of nearly 10,000 at Dalymount Park. And, you know, I mean, this is crazy. This is at the kind of the third peak of the pandemic in 1919. So, you know, I'm not saying everyone was just constantly gathering in crowds and like coughing in each other's faces and licking door handles or whatever, but you have a situation where, you know, schools were closed for a period. A lot of businesses did close down because maybe someone in the family got flu and things like that, and they didn't want to run it. So people self-quarantined and so on. You know, people were wearing masks and things like that. And, you know, there's footage of that and things like that. But it was far more lax. We didn't have an equivalent of a level five or a level four. So football did continue. And in a weird way, everyone was kind of delighted football was continuing, especially the football clubs and the administrators, because they were finally getting, you know, people through the turnstiles.
When you were doing your research for this, what was the opinion towards football? What was the perception in Ireland? Because obviously you have the World War One, where there's Irish soldiers going to fight for the British Army, and that leaves us disdain for many people. And you also have the culture war, which took place in the late 1800s when you had the rise of the GAA. They're trying to fight back for the languages during home rule, and football is shunned. So at this stage in 1919, after all that has happened 20 years later, what's the actual public perception of football in Ireland?
Well, it's a funny one you ask, Ender, because it coincides with a lot of my research to give my own podcast, Bohemians for Life, a plug. I did a piece with Aaron O'Mike, who's a historian researcher, about prominent Irish soccer players who were involved in the revolutionary movement. So, I mean, the likes of Oscar Traynor, Joe Steins, the Robinson brothers. And actually, I have a piece coming out in the Bowes match programme for the game against Dundalk on Friday. So that's a day short of the 100th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. So I've gone through all the different Bowes connections involved with Bloody Sunday. So weirdly, the coach of the Dublin GAA team, Charlie Harris, who is a trainer for O'Toole's GAA club, who are based up around Sheriff Street at the time. Charlie Harris is also the trainer for the Irish national team and also has been trainer for Bohemians since 1916. So there's a big crossover there. There's a couple of members of Collins' squad are out that day. There's Sam Robinson, who's a scout, who's kind of basically keeping watch at one of the houses on Main Street. Sam Robinson goes on to become an Irish international, plays for Bohemians, wins the league title with them. Todd Andrews, who's a big Bowes fan, whose brother later captains the club, is basically out on Pembroke Road in a house that nearly gets burnt down on the morning of Bloody Sunday. So there's all sorts of interesting connections with, say, that sort of thing. The public attitude is an interesting one, because if you look at it, there's certainly an appetite for people to get back to matches. Now, what you would say, I suppose, is that it is confined to those kind of towns and urban centres that were always big into their football. So, you know, Dublin, Belfast, Sligo, there is kind of, at the time, I suppose, football is beginning to become more professionalised in its administration in places around, you know, Cork and Limerick and things like that. And, you know, you got to remember, a lot of these towns have a football tradition in the association code that goes back quite a long time. But yeah, there is always that kind of pejorative negative view of it that kind of emerges afterwards. There's kind of a little bit of a culture war after independence, I think. And you have this wonderful phrase, I think David Toms wrote about, someone describing it as the jazzing soccer golf stick brigade and all this sort of stuff, that you know, that these are imported customs and we should be celebrating our own customs. And that there is that view, and that becomes quite pronounced in the kind of 20s and 30s, I think. And, you know, there's taxes levied on football matches that aren't leveled on GAA games. So there's a thing called the entertainments tax. So maybe you say that's because GAA is an entertainment, but that's not subjected to Gaelic or hurling matches, but it is to soccer games and things like that. There's a great quote from Oliver St. John Dougherty, who, you know, he's a guy, he's a senator in the first BCA Senate. He's a guy who performs an autopsy on Michael Collins, who's a personal friend of his after he's been shot, and, you know, he uses his house as a safe house during the War of Independence. He's also a former right winger for Bohemians. And he says that, about the tax in the Senate, he says, well, it should be double tax because it's a bastardization of rugby and football. So Gaelic football should be double taxed. That's his view. So there is all sorts of competing attitudes. What I try to do is maybe tell the smaller stories. I think all the big stories are told, and, you know, even watch the wonderful documentary that RTE did on Bloody Sunday there recently, but you know, and there's been great scholarship and effort gone to that and books written on it. I like to try and tell some of the smaller stories, and a lot of the time there's that view that you know, everyone just basically thought everyone who was playing football was playing a garrison game, and they were all thought they were West Brits. That's not the case. It's much more complex, much more nuanced than that. And you have guys who are, you know, very, very prominent nationalists. I mean, Kevin Barry was a rugby player. Cathal Brua played cricket. Eamon de Valera played rugby and was nearly, you know, appeared for Munster, was called up for them. I mean, you have all these situations. Michael Cusack, the guy who founded the GAA, loved cricket, loved rugby.
He wanted cricket to be a part of the GAA.
Yeah. So, I mean, all these things are there. It's a very rich, layered history. And as kind of James said at the start of the podcast, we're sometimes great at doing things, but I think some of the smaller history, and certainly sports history, was kind of ignored as trivial and things like that. And the way I always look at it is these stories are a window into a moment in time. So I'm telling the story of the Spanish flu is a huge story to tell. It's a global pandemic that kills over 50 million people at a conservative estimate. I'm talking about a football club in Dublin that happened to be playing matches at the time. And it's maybe a little view into city life at the time and what people were doing, as a way, I hope, to tell a story that's engaging.
Yeah, and you can find Jerry's piece in the new issue of Pogba Goal, issue 6, which is available to pre-order now. If you want to listen to a really interesting podcast that we did on the nuances of history and history in sport, Paul Rouse did a podcast with us during the first lockdown, the history of sport, and he talks about these nuances and all the different intricacies of what was going on and what we don't really know about and what's propaganda and what's truth. And there's some really interesting stuff about the Irish revolutionary characters and their involvement in sport and how it's now being trying to change the idea that all these revolutionaries only cared about Irish things, because that's just not true. But where can people pre-order this, Jimmy, if they want to get a hold of this pre-order of Pogue McGoal issue 6?
So they can look for us on social media, which is at Pogue McGoal, or order the copy directly at pogemcgoal.bigcartel.com, but you'll find us on social media. And just to say, if you do like the type of content we've been talking about and Jerry's stuff, the pre-orders actually help us to bring out the print. So if you like what we do, that's a great way to support us.
Yeah, and I'll also put a link on the Team 33 Twitter account as well, at Team 33, all spelled out in words, if you want to get your hands on Pogue McGoal issue 6. The pre-order is available now. Jimmy Carew, co-editor of Pogue McGoal magazine, and Jared Farrell, thanks very much, lads.
Thanks, Andrew.
Team 33, this is OTB Sports Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Team 33, and a call here with you. If you missed that interview with Jimmy Carew and Gerald Farrell from Pogue McGoal magazine, you can catch that in the OTB Podcast Network, or you can also find it on the YouTube channel as well, youtube.com/offtheball. But Wrexham AFC have their new owners. And listen to this.
Not sure what to get your special someone this holiday?
Tired of them opening the same old scarf or sweater? Try Ivor Williams Trailers.
Ivor Williams Trailers has been Britain's leading trailer manufacturer for over 60 years.
Nothing says I'm thinking about you and your horse like Ivor Williams Trailer. Tilt bed, beaver tail, tipper, horse box, livestock, you name it.
So, if you're looking to really wow them this year,
and you own livestock,
visit
Ivor Williams. Why are Rob and I pitching a North Walian trailer manufacturer?
Well, because we just became owners of Wrexham Association Football Club, and they're our team sponsor. You may have never heard of Wrexham, the racecourse ground, or
Ivor Williams,
but you will. So to the Wrexham Supporters Trust, thank you for your faith and trust in us.
We are humbled, and we're already getting to work. This is really happening.
Here they come, our mighty champions. Raise your voices to the anthem.
The new owners there from Wrexham AFC in North Wales. Interesting characters. Mac from Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Deadpool are the new owners of Wrexham AFC, also known as Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds as well. And I'm delighted to say that Spencer Harris from Wrexham AFC, the director of Wrexham AFC, has joined me on the line now. Spencer, this is a weird and wonderful story that's come about over the last couple of months, but how did this actually happen? How did Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds end up owning a club in North Wales?
So I first got some contact from actually from the CEO of Portsmouth Football Club, asking me if I'd be interested in talking to somebody about investment into the football club. And they put me in touch with an investment bank in New York who talked to me about some people who were interested in investing, but couldn't say who they were at that point, other than they were extremely rich and famous people, and they were interested in hearing more about Wrexham. So I had some conversations, as we always do, on behalf of, because we're community owned at the moment, on behalf of our members, and had those discussions over a few weeks, just to talk a bit more about the club, its potential, what it does, where it is both on and off the pitch, and then we got into NDA and got introduced to Ryan and Rob, and the rest is history.
So talk to me a little bit about Wrexham's ownership model then. It's a fan-owned club, is it?
Or a fan? Yeah, we're a fan-owned club. So the Wrexham Supporters Trust is a community benefit society, and it owns the 100% shareholding in Wrexham AFC Limited. So the club itself is a limited company owned by a community benefit society. We took over the club back in 2011. It had been relegated out of the Football League some 4 years before, and our owners had unfortunately run up some significant debt and had to sell our ground, our training ground, and all of the land around the stadium to service some of their debt. And we took over the club for a pound, and it had operating losses of £750,000 per annum, and we took on £500,000 of debt. It took us 3 years to get onto an even keel, to get rid of all of the debt, and we've run a sustainable football club ever since. And today we have, even with COVID-19, we have a really successful business that's well cash flowed, and we will hand over the club cash in the bank and debt free.
And have you met Rob and Ryan prior to the vote that they would take over the club?
Yeah, so I first met Rob and Ryan back in August. Of course, due to COVID-19, all of my meetings with the guys have been over Zoom link or because it's just not possible to do travel between the US and North Wales at the moment. Mm-hmm. But even with that, we've been able to establish a good relationship and talk about what's in the best interest of the future of Wrexham Football Club.
They both have a massive following, obviously, from their time in TV and their time in films. And Rob especially would be someone that I would follow closely because I'd be a big Always Sunny in Philadelphia fan. And on his Twitter, it was quite funny watching him put up photos of him watching games of Wrexham on a stream, and even tweeting out asking, is there anywhere to find Wrexham football stream? It's difficult at times to find streams for a Premier League club, never mind a club like Wrexham. So are the lads aware of what they're getting into, or have they given you a sort of a detail on what their ambition for the club is?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if you think about, let's just talk about them as people for just one moment. They've really put themselves out there in this acquisition, because that's what it is. They would be taking on the 100% shareholding. And because we're community owned, it's not something that's been able to be done for them behind closed doors, and you know, where somebody could say yes or no. It's had to be at the right time, very public, and they've had to put themselves forward and to be scrutinised by the owners of the football club, the few thousand Wrexham fans, and for them to be asked questions, and for them to go through a vote process, and we've had to go through a vote process for their acquisition to be accepted, with a significantly high hurdle rate at 75% of people voting would need to accept it for the deal to go through. So that shows you how committed and serious the guys are. So that's the first thing I would say on the matter, really.
And I think it was around about 95% that actually voted in favour of it, right?
So we've had to have two SGMs. The first was to ask members to give them the outline terms of the deal and say, are you happy for us to continue discussions? So we held that back in September. And at that point, we couldn't tell, or we didn't tell, and we couldn't tell the our supporters and the owners who the people we were talking to were. We told them the bones of the deal, but not who the people were. We told them that they're you know famous and all of that sort of thing. And they voted a 95% majority at that point for us to continue discussions. And then as we've just gone through the process now, it was actually 99% of people who voted to support the guys in their ownership bid.
Yeah, and I suppose there's a couple of fan-owned clubs around Ireland as well, and it is quite a big thing to put your trust in an offshore's owner that's coming in, and especially someone who has such fame as the two guys do. So I suppose it can only be a win-win situation here for Wrexham, if I'm right, if the figures that they're saying that they're going to put into the club come to fruition, and even just the publicity of having the two guys involved must be something that's really exciting for the club.
Yeah, it's very exciting. But you touched on the sort of assurance and reassurance of fans piece there. One of the things that we've done in terms of our negotiation is that during our 9 years of ownership, we managed to get the effective ownership. We don't own the freehold, but we've got the effective ownership of the racecourse back, as well as turning around its financial performance. So we now own a 99-year lease on our stadium, the racecourse, which is the oldest international stadium still in use anywhere in the world. And we will retain the headline lease of the stadium and sublet to them as new owners of Wrexham AFC. So that will give some real comfort to people. And also what will give comfort to people is that we've agreed and as you know, contractually obliged that should they want to make some changes to things like club badge or the colours we play in or where we play, all those sorts of things, then they need to come and get approval from ourselves. And that shows you how community focused these guys are. And you know, how we're going to work in partnership. Okay, they will be the owners going forward, but we will continue to support them. And you know, with our, you know, for our level of football, we've got a significant fan base, really historical club, the third oldest professional club in the world. Even at our level of football, we get average gates of around 5,000 fans. And North Wales is a big place to have just one professional club. We've got around 900,000 people in the area. There's a lot of headroom to go at locally for expansion. But of course, I think their plans are also to take us international as well.
Yeah, and I suppose that all that sounds great, because if you look at previous takeovers, for example, the AFC Wimbledon takeover, the owner owned the lease to the stadium as well. So when the fans wanted to start their own club again, they didn't have that. And also the Cardiff City owner from a couple of years ago, name isn't coming into my head, when he came in and changed all the colours because he had some sort of superstitions around the colour red. So that all sounds really good and promising for X as well. I suppose before we finish up then, like, what is the end game here for Wrexham? What's the ceiling? Are you planning on trying to make a move for higher up into the National League, into the League Two, and see where it goes? Or is there a ceiling that you think that you eventually would like to get to?
Let's see where it goes. I don't want to put too much pressure on early doors, but obviously, you know, they've looked around and they could have bought a football club significantly higher up the pyramid than ourselves. But the reason that they've looked at Wrexham is because it's got the potential to go higher, and also where it is currently. You know, we've been a championship club before, and we have the catchment area to be able to at least sustain at that level. So they're really interested in the journey and moulding, shaping something. They've done that in their careers, but outside of their careers, they've built things and they really enjoy that, and they want to enjoy the journey, and hence why they're coming to us. You know, Ryan's done that with his aviation gin business and just sold it for 600 million plus to Diageo, right? So that's what these guys enjoy. They're big sports fans, not necessarily great knowledge on football, and they would say that if they were on this podcast themselves, but they will get people about them who do know about football, and they're going to enjoy the ride, and so will we.
Well, best of luck with it anyway. I really hope it goes well, and it'll be something that there will definitely be people watching Wrexham and paying attention to Wrexham over the next couple of years that weren't before. Spencer Harris, director of Wrexham AFC, thanks very much for joining me today.
No problem. Nice to speak to you.
Team 33. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Team 33. So that's about all we have time for on this evening's show. Thanks to you for listening. And again, if you missed any of that show, you can find us in the OTB Podcast Network as well. Subscribe to the podcast if you want to get notified every time a new podcast goes live, or you can get it on the YouTube channel as well, youtube.com/offtheball. There's some really good stuff up there from the Brendan Bradley interview, which I mentioned in the first part of the show, and the LOI Legends series. And you can also find the History of Sport podcast as well with Paul Rouse in the highlights section. I think he actually has his own section on the OTB Podcast Network as well, Paul Rouse's History of Sport. You can check that out. Loads of great stuff up there as well. But that is all we have time for on this evening's show. We will be back again in the same place and the same time. But until then, take away, Johan.